Welcome to the Ephesiology Podcast, a podcast dedicated to the study of the early Christian movement and its implications for the church today. Today, you have me, Andrew Johnson, a pastor at Neartown Church, and we are joined, as always, by Michael, our resident Ephesiologist. Michael, it is so good to see your face.
I know. It's been a while, hasn't it? I was just thinking, we were just talking, that this is May. I've been in 5 countries in 5 months. That's crazy, isn't it?
That's not a record for you by any stretch, but that's a lot.
That's a little bit of miles.
My goodness. Okay, so obviously for our listeners, they just listened to us catching up with Jeff Christofferson. That wasn't that long ago. They haven't really missed us because that's been pretty recent. But the reality is there were a lot of weeks in between some of those recordings. So it's been a minute since you and I have caught up. Can you safely describe where you have been you've had 2 major trips. Can you describe what those have been and what you've been up to?
So I've been in the Middle East, I guess on 2 different occasions.
Right.
And then in South Asia and then Europe. So Europe, I can freely talk about. The one occasion in the Middle East, we'll get into a little bit more detail, but the other opportunities, less so. Okay. But yeah, I mean, overall, just great trips. Always such a joy to be with brothers and sisters in the Lord and hear what they're doing and their testimonies. And it's just always so encouraging to be able to learn and listen and see what the Lord is doing in some places that aren't always... places that aren't always on our radar, places that, you know, our friends in there are often persecuted or facing hardships in ways that we just can't relate to in the West. So, but overall, super encouraging time. It was a lot of fun to be able to travel to South Asia with a couple of our students. And to work with a group of leaders that talking about the adaptive nature of the church and what that means in their context, and hearing stories of their successes and struggles and so on. And then
pause you on that just for a second, because there's like a slew of thoughts that I'm having run through my mind. For those who may not be avid listeners of Ephesiology or who have stumbled upon us recently, when you mention such things as the adaptive nature of the church and seeing that in its beauty, is that heresy, Michael? Are you really excited about the church changing into something new and different, and then all of us are going to go to hell in a handbasket? what do you mean when you say the adaptive nature of the church?
Yeah, you know what? I am super excited about this idea, and that goes to my our Lori and I, our second trip to the Middle East. Do we think of this country as the Middle East? I suppose. It has aspects of the Middle East because it's a Muslim country. I mean, it's a secular country, but Muslim majority people. Mm-hmm. And this one I can talk about, and that's Turkey.
Okay, good. I was like, how much do I have to like monitor my questions to you on this one? So So Turkey, I mean, it splits both. It's the only country on 2 continents.
Yeah.
You know, it's in Europe and it's in Asia.
Yeah. Yeah. And our time there was a research trip, visiting some of the archaeological sites in what is often referred to as Roman Asia or Asia Minor. And that trip, I think, solidified in my mind in fresh ways and and it was confirming as well, just the adaptive nature of the church. I mean, we saw examples. We met with archaeologists while we were there, saw examples, literal, physical, archaeological examples of how the church adapted from the maybe late first century, second century for sure, but even going into the period after the Christianization of the empire in the 300s. And just really fascinating examples of this that confirm to me that the church was never intended to be a monolithic structure, but had always, it seems, adapted to its context. And so to
elaborate, yeah, or to tease this out, when you say the church has adapted, the church adapted in that era, moving into different times, it's not supposed to be this monolithic thing. You're not just talking about archaeologists saying, and look at the, you know, the style of the pillars changed in this shows. You're not talking about a physical building structure changing in the church. You're talking about something more significant, correct?
Well, it's a both and. I mean, we saw the building changes. We saw repurposing of places, for example. And so all of that, I think we have to take into consideration. Mm-hmm. And you know, I think both of us, Lori and I, walked away from that trip, maybe more so me because I think so much about this, thinking that, you know, we need to pay more attention to some of the archaeological record and what it's telling us about the early church, and maybe tone down a little bit of our polemics against what we've called the legacy church. Now, I don't think that we've done that. But there are a lot of folks that have kind of poo-pooed
denigrated
what's happened in the, yeah, what's that?
I said denigrated.
Denigrated, yeah, the legacy church for one reason or another. And I mean, there certainly are reasons to be critical, I think constructively, about the what we've called the legacy church. But what we were observing, at least in the archaeological record in Asia Minor, was that, you know, the size of the church necessitated, in some instances, corresponding buildings. And when I say the size of the church, what I mean is the size of the body of Christ, the numbers of people, the sheer numbers of people that had come to Christ and were gathering together. It did not accommodate what typically we think of in terms of the early house church in the New Testament record. And even that, there... when we were in Laodicea, we spent a lot of time in Laodicea, and there are some clear, I mean, and then in Sardis, I mean, it's just amazing to think about these things. But in Laodicea, there's clear archaeological testimony to a house church there that that could easily seat 100-150 people.
Ooh.
And, oh yeah. And so it's not, you know, when we think of house church, you know, we typically will think of a small gathering,
a small living room.
Yeah, in a living room, you know, that might accommodate 10, 15, maybe 20 people. But in this context, and I think this kind of brings a little illumination to 1 Timothy chapter 3, when Paul says to Timothy, you know, you're to remain here and appoint an overseer. And that overseer is somebody who manages his household or his oikos well. And what we know about that oikos in the first century was that it wasn't just simply, you know, the nuclear family, but it was the network of the household that was literally managed by an overseer who was responsible as much for the social aspects of the network as the financial aspects or the economic and the religious aspects of this. And so that network often would the same household, and you can literally see that in the archaeological record. You see, you know, where there were different living quarters for different people. Presumably, some of those quarters were for servants as well as others in the household. And in this one instance in Laodicea, there's clearly probably what should be understood as was called a private basilica. And when I say basilica, I don't mean a church, but literally the term was used as kind of a private audience hall, if you will, or sometimes it might have been used as a lecture hall or some sort of meeting space for the, you know, the head of the household to gather business partners or networks or whatever. But in this instance, in this particular room that, you know, these private halls would often have an apse. This one has an apse. But it was marked at its entrance by a distinct Christian symbol that seems to indicate that it was actually the place of the gathering of believers. Now, it could have been used to gather other things as well.
Right.
But it seems that this was also distinctly a location where Christ followers gathered together in some form or fashion. You know, we don't know what they did mm-hmm. in these places necessarily. I mean, we have some references, of course, to the teaching that would go on, the fellowship and so on that would happen in these places, the eating of meals together. And these particular halls were conducive to that type of fellowship. And so anyway, I mean, it's just, if you can't tell that I'm excited about this, I am excited about this.
This sounds well, there's a lot of value even in what you are seeing and what we are, some of the things that we have been reflecting on. My mind goes back to a previous episode where we talked to Heath Haynes, and one of Heath's big desires, I know, is that there's so much noise these days of my idea or this thing is better. And thus it's, if it's better, that means your thing or your idea is worse. And so we get into this polemic battle. There's only one right way, right? And Heath is saying we desperately need house churches. We need small. We need missional communities that are nimble. We also still need the legacy church. There is an absolute, not just a place, not just like a pat it on the head. Aren't you cute? Yeah, you know, you can have your place too. It's like, no. They're actually both extremely valuable and necessary in a society. And it's not surprising that you are looking back at archaeological records that say, hey, look, that's actually been true in church history too.
Yeah. And what it tells us is, again, it's reiterating the adaptive nature of the church. It utilizes the spaces where communities could gather in ways that were meaningful at that time period. And so to assume some sort of monolithic whatever paradigm for the church, I think, is to misread the church history and really to misread the archaeological record. Because what we see is that the church utilized all sorts of space. And again, in Laodicea, we had just the wonderful privilege to meet with a couple archaeologists, and they were very excited to show us some of the things that they were discovering. And one of the remarkable structures there is one of two theaters. They're nearly complete with the one theater. They haven't started excavating the second theater, but okay. Laodicea apparently had two theaters. The larger one is just an incredible sight to see. And, you know, you stand in the theater, use your imagination about all of the things that were going on. So we were talking about, you know, different aspects of the theater, and there are inscriptions about people who had donated funds to help with the construction of the theater and so on. And at one moment, he leaned over to me and said, "Do you want to see something interesting?" I said, "Well, absolutely."
I mean, everything I'm looking at is boring, so sure, yeah. Something interesting.
And so he said, come with me. He said, "This has not been published yet, and so you can't take any photos." And I thought, "Well, this is going to be super cool." And so we walk over to just a kind of a small field of columns and capitals of columns, mm-hmm. and the bases of columns, all that had been excavated out of the theater. And they had just been, you know, going through and cataloging these things. And so there were a couple guys weed whacking some of the weeds away, right. from the columns and capitals and bases. And so they finished, and he walks over and he's searching for something. And he says, "Okay, come here and look at this." And he showed us a couple different instances of capitals, the top of a column, mm-hmm. that had crosses on them. And he says, "We suspect that the Christians used this theater as a place of gathering of some sort." And this is no small place. I mean, this place, yeah. would seat easily 10 to 15,000 people.
Whoa.
Yeah. Yeah.
Sorry, so, that was this a bigger number than I was expecting.
Well, no, but, and think of this. This is Laodicea. And we know from Jesus's letter to that church in Revelation chapter 3 that they were having some problems. He was not at all happy with what was going on at Laodicea. In fact, you remember, he says, "I wish that you were hot or cold, but being lukewarm, I'm just going to spew you out of my mouth." And so this was not a place that... I mean, it was a place where, yeah. there were issues, to say the least. But just think about this. If, in fact, in this city of Laodicea, now this would have been, these column capitals with crosses on them would have dated to the time of the Christian Empire. So 4th, 5th century.
Okay.
And so something happened in that gathering of people, mm-hmm. that resulted in thousands of people from Laodicea coming to Christ. And you can see it's just so exciting to think about how that letter from Jesus warning the church,
right.
was impactful to such an extent that city was saturated with people who were following Christ. And so that, I mean, that's just really, really exciting to think about and to see it. I mean, and right. you know, to see that this is a part of the record.
That's incredible. I think, I don't know if I have ever paused to say, what was the rest of the story? You know what I mean? When we have the 7 warnings from Jesus in those letters, or 6.5 warnings, 6, you know what I mean?
Well, actually 5 warnings.
5 warnings, yeah, and
yep.
2 encouragements.
Yeah. Yeah.
But like what was the result of those letters? What happened, yeah. in each, yeah. of those cities? What happened to the church there? How did they respond?
Yeah. Well, and that's what's so cool about being there and seeing, you know, the Christian symbols, the artifacts, it's being there and realizing that the things that you might expect to see, you're not seeing as well. That was just as fascinating.
Like what?
Well, I mean, one of the things that you would expect, or there were several things.
I'll give you a few minutes. You can come up with 10.
Yeah, right. Well, one of the things is, you know, we hear so much about the ichthus, the Greek word for fish, symbolized by, you know, that fish symbol that mm-hmm. is so popular, especially down south on the back of cars.
Uh-huh.
Right. And you would have expected to see that symbol more prevalent, and you don't. There was one instance that I saw what might have been an ichthus, but who knows if it was or not. But the other symbol, and since being there, I've gone and read a couple scholarly articles on this, but is the ichthus wheel. It's an 8-spoked wheel that was very prevalent and often marked places where Christians gathered, or in Ephesus, for example, it potentially marked places of Christian business. And so that was not expected. The other thing that I thought that I would see more of but didn't were the crucifixion. And we saw a number of crosses, and many of those crosses, when they are, you know, used as an ornament, of course, are dating to the 4th, 5th century, 6th century, maybe. But there were other instances where they were etched in to places. But never did we see a cross with a crucifixion, except in one instance in the museum in Ephesus, where it was clearly a Byzantine period cross with a crucifixion on it. It was carved into the actual cross itself. But one instance of that. And that was interesting as well. And I think there's some, we can't get into it here, but there are some reasons why we're not seeing the crucifixion to being prevalent, you know, in Asia Minor. And then you, because of later influences, you would have thought that you would see more images of Mary, because particularly in the city of Ephesus, which was the location of the Ecumenical Council in 431 that declared Mary as the Mother of God. But there just weren't what you would expect. There weren't the images of Mary, of the Madonna, you see it later. So for example, and you've been here to the Hagia Sophia, where Mary is very prominent, and literally the frescoes in Hagia Sophia talk about Mary as the Mother of God. But when you get down, at least it seemed to me, when you're in the area of Asia Minor, it just didn't seem to factor in as prominently as I would have expected. So anyway, I mean, things like that, it's just absolutely fascinating to have had that privilege and looking forward to where this might lead us.
Okay, so speaking of where this might lead us, are you ready to make the announcement, or at least advertise about what potential coolness is coming up in the future?
Yeah, sure.
Please do.
We are planning in November, from November 4th to 15th, taking a small group of 15 people back to Asia Minor, specifically to do more research. I came away from that trip with a gazillion questions. And I'm excited about the opportunity to return and begin to explore some of those questions, but really excited about the opportunity to do that in a community of others who are interested, not just in a tour. I mean, we're not going there to Right. tour around. We'll spend 10 days in the different locations and really begin to focus in on what does this mean? If these are the things that we're seeing or we're not seeing, what does this mean for that time period? But how does it impact us today? How might it help our thinking about the New Testament record? And how might it help us as we're thinking about the implications of that record on us for today? So I'm looking forward to that trip. The trip is already organized. We have a great partner in Turkey that's helping us. And it's just going to be a stellar opportunity to spend some time in a community of learners and to think about, you know, what if this or what if that, and if that is the case, then what does that mean for our understanding of the New Testament, and what are the implications for us today?
I mean, it almost sounds like we have a podcast dedicated to the study of the early Christian movement and maybe somehow its implications for the church today. This trip that you're talking about seems very in line with what we have set out to do.
Yeah, you know, I think as I think about it, it's going to be ephesiology on steroids, I think. Because it's not, you know, the book, I mean, I'm of course biased since I authored the book. And
you?
But I think the book does a great job in giving us a sketch of the first century church from the New Testament record. And this trip is going to give us some confirmation of that record, but also might stretch our thinking as well. Like, mm-hmm. you know, for example, what is meant by the house church, or what do we do with a Christian gathering in a place that seats 15,000 people? What do we do with all the symbols that we're seeing there? And what do we do? Here's another example. When we were in Sardis, there's a very well preserved, what is believed to have been a very well preserved synagogue next to the gymnasium in mm-hmm. Sardis. And so we were looking around this gymnasium or in the synagogue, and it's a large space. I mean, it's no small place. It could easily handle probably 500 or more people. So it's mm-hmm. a larger space. Mm-hmm. But in the narthex of the synagogue, when you're coming into it, it's kind of a peristyle colonnade area with a okay. water feature in the middle.
Oh, okay.
But as you're approaching it, there are two symbols there, which are stunning. One is the ichthus wheel, which is now scholars debate. Some are saying that this is a game that was popular in the time period, and that just seems a little much.
It was really, really popular. Like it was Pokemon Go, and yeah. they inscribed it everywhere.
Right. Which doesn't seem right, but it seems like there's a scholarly consensus that this actually was a Christian symbol. So there's that symbol. And then next to it is the symbol of a menorah that has the image of a cross on it as well. And we saw something wow. similar to this in Laodicea, where there was a menorah etched into a column and a cross coming out of it. And the consensus in the Laodicea instance is that this represents the idea that the Christianity comes out of Judaism. And that seems to be at least what I would tentatively suggest in Sardis, the same type of thing. I mean, when you have the menorah and the cross coming together,
right.
That's really a remarkable symbol, if not statement, of the impact that Jesus has had in the synagogue at Sardis. Combined with that, there are Greek inscriptions in the synagogue as well, which confirm the idea that Hebrew was not spoken in the synagogue, but Greek was. And I was just before we jumped on the podcast, I was looking at those inscriptions and trying to do some translation of them. And the one line that I can make out is that there was something that was gifted to that community that seems to have been some sort of musical instrument, which was interesting to be able to decipher, if it's correct. We'll check and see. But anyway, so those kinds of things I just think are very insightful for us, and it helps us to get a picture of, you know, how Christianity impacted the community and how extensive that impact was.
Well, this sounds incredible. How much should people start saving for that is concurrent with their application to join this trip?
Yeah, the total price of the trip, it's 10 days in Asia Minor. We're visiting Laodicea, Sardis, Ephesus, of course, Smyrna, Pergamum, all of the seven churches, as well as Miletos and a couple other cities. And it's all inclusive, includes the hotel, breakfast, dinner. Lunches will be on our own because we'll be out in the field, but includes all the travel in the country and all of these things. And for that 10 days, it's $2,100. Wow. We're also have flight arrangements. And so for those who would join us from the U.S., we'd be flying out of Detroit. And that's an additional $1,290 round trip into Smyrna. So we fly directly into the Izmir, the ancient city of Smyrna, and kind of set up shop there. And we go out from there, and we'll spend different nights in different places. Trying to see what we see and think about missiologically, what does this mean? And that's the question that archaeologists aren't asking. And rarely are the theologians asking this question. What is the missiological significance of what we're observing here? And you just think of, you know, if in fact that synagogue in Sardis does become a Christian community, if the house church in Laodicea is indeed a house church that was located in someone of prominence in their house. There's something similar in the terrace house in Ephesus as well. And, you know, if these things are what they are, then what does that mean missiologically for us? How does it show us the ways in which the believers in these places connected with the communities to so incredibly impact them that eventually they become very significant places of Christianity?
This is incredible. Well, Michael, I don't think it's a big stretch to say you have quite adequately whet the appetite of this potential trip. Thank you so much for sharing all of that with us. If you are interested in checking out more information about this tour, where on our website would they go?
Yeah, we'll include it in the show notes and in the description of the podcast, but it's on the Ephesiology Masterclasses site, and included there are a couple, three background courses that will help to make the time even more enriching, as well as a number of academic articles that will give some more background to the things that we're going to be seeing, and hopefully begin to illumine our imagination about the impact, the implications of the things that we'll see.
Man, I'm excited for what comes out of that. If you, one of the wonderful listeners, are a part of this trip, you are in for a treat. So if you have stumbled upon our podcast, if you have never checked us out before, please jump on whatever podcast app you have, go into our back catalog, find some things, find some people we have talked to, say, okay, well, before I go and travel halfway across the world with these folks, what are they about? And I echo Michael's encouragement, go to masterclasses.ephesiology.com. Look into this trip as well as many of the other resources that we have to encourage as well as equip you for the ministry that God is calling all of his people to in this world. So today, for Michael and myself, thank you for joining us on the Ephesiology Podcast.